Sugar Babies. The musical is comprised of sketches taken from old burlesque routines. It was Ralph Allen, an authority on burlesque, who found the sketches and rewrote them. Today at 4:15, he'll tell us about the humor you typically find in burlesque, and by way of example, he'll tell us some of his favorite sketches. Peter Sellers died this week of a heart attack at the age of 54. At 4 o'clock today, we'll hear a short tribute to this actor of many voices and personalities who claimed that he had no real personality of his own. Fresh Air's film reviewer Bill Van Wert will be here at his regular 3:30 time today to discuss the film The Blues Brothers and to highlight movies that you can see this coming week on television. The American Friends Service Committee recently sent a delegation to El Salvador to investigate charges of human rights violations. This afternoon at about 2:45, Dr. Walter Lear, who recently returned from El Salvador, and Jose Arias of El Salvador, who is against the military junta there, will be with us to speak with Ralph Flood about the junta and the popular movement in El Salvador. With me now on Fresh Air is John Fahey, whose spatial and blues-tinged style has influenced many guitarists, and his record company, Tacoma Records, has recorded many fine guitarists. Although Fahey is a self-taught guitarist who says he never had a lesson, he has had an interesting formal education, having received a B.A. in Philosophy and Religion from American University and an M.A. in Folklore and Mythology in 1967 from the University of California at Berkeley. Fahey has about 18 albums of his own that he's recorded, and tonight in Philadelphia and tomorrow night you'll have an opportunity to hear him perform live at the Main Point. There'll be two sets each of those nights, 8 and 10 o'clock. For more information, you can call the Main Point at 525-3375. Also, John Fahey has brought his guitar with him this afternoon and has said that he'll do some playing for us. And, John, I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. And before we talk a little bit about your music, maybe you can play a tune for us to open this up.
Oh, okay. I'll play On the Sunny Side of the Ocean. Thank you.
thanks. That's John Fahey playing in the WUHY studios for us this afternoon. He's in Philadelphia to perform tonight and tomorrow night at the Main Point. So you're self-taught. You really never took a lesson. How did you learn to play?
Well, Well, I was in this park, and I was about 12 or 13, and I saw these other guys, and they had guitars, and they were picking up girls. And so I got a $17 Susan Robot guitar, and I got them to show me a few chords, you know, just by, I mean, it's not really a lesson, you know, like, show me a G chord and a C chord. And so then I set up my own stand, sort of trying to pick up girls, but I wasn't successful. But in the process, I learned to play the guitar. Then I got a chord book later on so I could learn some more chords. Oh, and they all played with a flat pick. I couldn't learn to play with a flat pick, so I played this way.
You use finger picks now? That's really true, though, honestly.
Yeah, that's right. It was a social thing. I was lonely. I wanted a girlfriend.
No, but really...
That's the only reason I got...
A guitar used to get you very far. People in the park with a guitar on their back had...
It didn't get me anywhere.
Didn't, huh? I wonder if...
got all the other guys, so... I'm still jealous.
I wonder if guitar has the status that it used to. You know, you don't see people playing folk songs in the park and having crowds gather around their around them, clapping their hands and swaying like you used
to. Was before folk music. This was country western stuff. You know, like this was in the early 50s. You know, before the folk music revival, quote unquote. You know, I mean,
what were you doing during that quote unquote folk music
hiding
revival?
From it.
Were you really?
Yeah, really.
You didn't feel a part of that at all?
No.
What did you think of the music that was happening?
Was it
the people and the scene in general, or the music that you were hiding from?
Yeah, I didn't like most of the people in the audience.
Why not?
Well, they didn't understand what was going on. I mean, the whole thing was real comic if you were at a distance, but if you were at a folk festival, you know, for example, two of the black guys that played at these things were pretty good friends of mine. Or I had rediscovered Booker White, and he was a pretty good friend. Skip James I didn't know too well, so I knew a couple of the others. And they'd go to places like, where was the big one? Providence? Newport.
No, Newport, yeah.
Newport. Well, one of the guys I knew, first of all, these were all retired blues men, you know, who couldn't understand what's going on, you know, what's the big deal about? And we're just going to it because it was a job. I mean, Robert P. Williams said to me, what is this, a great big open door whorehouse? I mean, he said that at Newport, you know, like, what's going on? I mean, why are all these people making such a fuss about this? And a few of them, like, I like Reverend Robert Wilkins, he's a real sharp guy. He knew what was going on, you know, and he enjoyed going, and he could still play, but most of them couldn't play as well, you know, as they had when they recorded 78s and were selling commercially to black audiences. That's who they were recording for. And here they were, you know, mainly playing for white kids. You know, and the white kids thought that these guys were still active entertainers in their own black communities, right? Well, they weren't. They hadn't been in 20 or 30 years. So there was all this real misunderstanding going on. And, you know, also I would go to festivals and invariably get depressed because most of the singers were real old, you know, black and white, and they just couldn't hack it anymore, you know. And I wanted, you know, I had their old records. I collected old records. And, you know, I wanted to hear them in their prime and, so to speak, die noble deaths, you know, rather than sort of be out there kind of. I mean, I was at one in Memphis, and they had the world's oldest living blues singer. That's what they call him. I forget the guy's name, but he was over 100 years old. And, I mean, Sleepy John Estes was really couldn't do anything anymore. He didn't even know where he was, it looked like.
So you're saying you think that the audience was really naive and not noticing the difference between someone who could perform well and someone who couldn't?
Yeah, right.
I've
also... What these folks, let's call them folk entertainers, you know, what their real significance in their own community was, you know, which was zilch, musically or in terms of entertainment at the time, you know, like, but your city kids were thinking, oh, they're still up in the mountains playing Elizabethan ballads, you know.
Well, that's a funny thing, because a lot of folk musics seem to lose their audiences and then find new ones, because, well, particularly with radio, so many different forms of commercial music have taken over the music that was played before, because radio keeps current all the time. So people whose styles come from the 20s or the 30s might not even get airplay in any part of the country.
Well, not only might, but probably don't.
Oh, when did you feel you found your audience?
What, when?
Yeah, how did you feel you developed a rapport with the people who could understand your music and appreciate what you were doing?
Well, the main thing I was trying to do was just make the steel string guitar, you know, a legitimate concert instrument. And took quite a lot of fighting, because everybody always wanted me to sing or something, which I can't do very well, you know. Or I'd show up with, this still happens, I show up with a guitar and they say, well, what are you going to sing tonight? And that's the main thing I accomplished, because now it is a legitimate instrument. I mean, I played at Carnegie Hall and stuff, you know. And other people are playing steel string guitars. Yeah.
When you
don't have to sing, you know, you can. Excuse me, you know, you can just play the guitar.
Do you ever feel when an audience is really enthusiastic about you that they're being as naive about you as they were being at the Newport Folk Festivals?
Well, no, because I don't pretend I'm a folk. I mean, I was born and raised around cities and went to college and. I don't consider myself a folk, mm-hmm. if there's such a thing as a folk. My music, you know, I steal folk tunes, incorporated in some of my pieces, or some folk harmonies, but I draw on all kinds of sources, you know, classical.
You draw on a lot of, like, turn of the century.
Yeah, that
popular
too.
Popular song, too.
Yeah. And,
Where'd you learn a lot of what became your influences? Through records, mostly?
Yeah, I had, like I was telling you, I had spent an awful lot of time in the South going door to door, you know, looking for old Victrolas records, you know.
Did you really do that?
Yeah. You know, months and months of it, buying up all the old records. And I couldn't afford to keep them.
What part of the country did you do this in? Did you?
I did it from Maryland and Delaware all the way to Texas and Oklahoma and everything in between in the South. So you wouldn't find good records in the North.
People think you were crazy wanting their old records?
Some people did, yeah. And so I play crazy if they wanted. And I stopped doing it. I didn't stop doing it until the middle, the summer those two, three kids got killed in Mississippi, right? You know, I was getting mistaken for a civil rights worker everywhere I went. And I was getting locked up and stuff. And I felt that summer somebody was going to get killed before it happened. And I didn't want it to be me. So, and the records weren't starting to turn up much anymore. They're pretty rare.
Were you knocking on doors in mostly white or black neighborhoods?
Primarily black, but I went into white neighborhoods, too. Yeah. If they were old enough. I was just looking for old more than, because black people would have white records and white people would have black records. They just had to be old. I was looking for pre-Second World War stuff. And, you know, lace curtains. I looked for lace curtains and flower pots.
What did everyone have more than anything else? What were the records that kept turning up?
Blue Yodel number one. So, but it's
Jimmy
just
Rogers?
Jimmy. Yeah, but it's just called Blue Yodel. I probably saw more copies of that. Yeah. I think that, you know, anything else.
Yeah, you would see a completely different set of 78s if you were knocking on doors in northeastern cities.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So.
I tried them, you know, but you'd find white pop stuff, not even good jazz, or very rarely.
A lot of Bing Crosby,
Yeah,
Paul Whiteman,
right.
a lot of.
Swing bands, you know, but stuff's not worth anything, and you can still buy it. I mean,
What have you done with all those records that you've
oh,
collected?
I auctioned them all off. See, I just taped what I liked. I couldn't afford to keep them and keep the trips up. I was still, like, I'm still looking for two records that haven't turned up by Charlie Patton, you know.
What are you looking for?
Blues singer. He did a Jim Lee Blues Part One and Some Summer Days on the other side, and I forget the name of the other record, but you know, we know what was issued, but we don't, and I mean, but a few of the records haven't turned up. And he's my favorite blues singer. So I still keep in touch with collectors. And in fact, I was just down in Ohio and I stopped at a place that sells old records and I picked up a Jelly Roll Morton piano solo on Red Jeanette, I mean, which I've never even seen one before. And it really had good luck. I got about this many jazz. It was jazz and hillbilly, real good hillbilly. In Ohio, you know, way up north.
Do you listen to records much anymore now that you have your own record company and make lots of records of your own?
Two things should be said here. And one is that, you know, I taped what I liked, and I still listen to that a lot. You know. But I don't own my record company anymore. I sold it to Chrysalis.
Oh, I
about
see. I
a
thought they
year
were just
ago.
distributing it for
No,
you.
they own 51% of the stock. And Leo Kottke, Denny Bruce, his manager, and their lawyer own the other 49%. And I work for them as an A&R man. I get $25 a week.
Seriously?
Yeah, I'm serious. But Tacoma was like $60,000 in debt or something when they bought it, and I still came out with, you know, a few thousand. So I'm happy.
Good. Well, I want to talk about Tacoma a little more, but
Also, yeah,
if.
okay, but you know, you can't run these little labels anymore. You just can't make it.
Well,
I
before
mean,
we talk about
yeah,
why, can you
okay.
play another tune for us?
Yeah, okay, but you know, I'm in the wrong position. I couldn't play that. See, I
Oh,
should
do
be
you want
sitting like this. Can I move it myself?
Wait, be careful with the mic.
Yeah. I move mics all the time. I was making a lot of mistakes in the last piece because it was.
Are you comfortable now?
Yeah, this is fine.
Okay. John Fahey is my guest if you're just joining us, and he's going to be performing at the Main Point tonight and tomorrow night with sets at 8 and 10. And if you'd like any information about John Fahey's performance, you can call the Main Point at 525-3375.
the endless guitar.
Shaking out the last note from the guitar. John Fahey is my guest, and let's talk a little bit about Tacoma Records. What year did you start the label?
I'm pretty sure it was 59. It might have been late 58. You know,
also, it was a long time ago before it was as popular to have independently owned and run record labels.
Right.
Lots of folk and jazz musicians now, even rock musicians, some of them, or new wave musicians, put out records on their own label. But that was pretty unusual back then. Why did you decide to do it?
I wanted to... Well, I suppose I wanted to make money, first of all. And I wanted to make money playing the guitar, second of all, and make the guitar a respectable concert instrument. So I thought I should have some records out. And I was living in Maryland at the time, and I was nowhere near any record companies. I knew nothing about record companies. So I borrowed some money. The first record I put out 100 copies, you know, with covers and everything. The whole thing cost me $300. So, you know, it wasn't a big investment. And then in 62, I put out my second record. And I met a guy who was a big record distributor without knowing he was a record distributor. I thought he was a 78 collector, period, you know. And I used to go over to his house, and one time I brought him over my copy of my second record. And he says, "Hey, you know, I'm a record distributor too. Why don't you sell me a few copies of that, and I'll see if I can sell it," you know. So, this was in San Francisco, and for some reason it started selling in Boston. So I went to Boston for a while and played in Boston. And then it started selling in San Francisco, and so I went back to San Francisco. And then I started getting calls from all over the place, and going on the road.
Eventually, you started recording other people.
Also. Yeah, well, we started making money, you know. So I can, you know, I didn't want to confine it to myself. I mean, that'd be boring.
Were you able to keep up making money from Tacoma Records?
Yeah, until the oil price went up. See, records are made out of oil. And even a couple years after the first oil price raise, you know, we still made pretty good money. But then, no matter what we put out, of course I have to admit, we also didn't have any very big sellers in the last few years.
One thing that's understood within the record industry, maybe you'll have some insight into this. I remember about 7 years ago or six years ago, who remembers, there was a vinyl shortage, we were told, and record prices shot up.
Yeah.
And people were starting to recycle records.
Yeah.
And now what's been happening is those LP-sized 45. So you have like 3 minutes of music.
Oh, those dumb disco records?
Yeah, and you have, say, 3 or 4 or 5 minutes of music. Maybe it's more like 5 to 10 minutes of music, but on the size of a record where you could get 30 minutes
record.
Of music.
Yeah, right.
Why, do you have any insight as to why that's been happening?
Well, there must still be, I think there was, and I think there still is a vinyl shortage compared to what there used to be. And they make cheaper records now. I mean, you've got a larger percentage of recycled records in there, so you have more cracks and pops. And the 12-inch 45 disco records is just a ridiculous rip-off. I mean, you might as well put them on 7-inch, you know. You can't improve the fidelity. I mean, you can't really... You could make the grooves wider, but I mean, the fidelity cutoff is at 45 RPMs, and then there's another big cutoff at 33 1/3, and from, I mean, it's, they're just trying to make money, trying to get, so they can charge more per record. But it looks funny. I mean, I agree with you, you know, it looks really weird to suddenly a 45 is on a 12-inch record. It's crazy. They just charge more.
Were there things you wanted to do with your record company that you felt weren't being done, besides the music that you were recording, but approaches to treating the artists and distribution of the records, packaging of the records?
Well, man, treating the artists, of course, I was one of the artists, so we used to pay the artists half the profits and keep the overhead real low. And then that became impossible because of the employees. I couldn't boss the employees around too well. Because I'm always out on the road, right?
Right.
And I go back and they put out a new record of somebody I never heard of. The last several years of the company, I had no control over it. And I put it up for sale, and I was very disgusted. It's possible, but I can't prove it. But it is possible that if they'd done what I wanted them to do and told them to do, it'd still be in existence, or I'd still own it. Because all the big sellers that we had, you know, Kotke, Mike Aldridge, or a couple others, were, you know, I picked them. Thought they would sell, and they did.
You know. I've always wondered, someone like you, if you encounter someone who's a really excellent guitarist, if a part of you isn't self-protective or perhaps jealous of what they might become, and if they might usurp your position in any way.
That's a good question. As a guitarist. I don't worry about it. I know people who do worry about that, but I don't worry about that much because, I don't know. It feels like there's plenty of room if you're good enough for guitarists. I mean, I keep working more. You know, I work more and more every year. It just seems like acoustic guitars are getting more and more popular. They're still selling more, you know, per capita.
Have your audiences changed much?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they were always pretty much, I think, a graduate school audience, you know, or older. Not too much undergraduates. Although you see them sometimes too. And it's an audience. I can't explain this, but it's a northern audience. Like I don't. If I go into the South, nobody listens to me. Nobody shows up. I don't know why that is, but it is.
Does there seem to be any differences to you between West Coast and East Coast audiences?
No, it's the same as long as you're North.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's interesting. Because people love to generalize it. People love to say that, like, on the West Coast, no one reads books. And
that's true in the
people in the lifestyle there are so different. The Southern West Coast.
I think they read up in Oregon and Washington.
Well, you're living in Los Angeles now.
Yeah, right.
How do you like that?
Oh, I don't like it, but I like it better in San Francisco.
Why?
Well, there's nothing in Frisco. Everybody in Frisco thinks, oh, we have this great this and this great that. And they don't. They don't have a symphony orchestra. They have an opera. Okay, they have an opera, if you like opera. I don't like opera. But I do like symphony orchestras and art museums and writers and, you know, so forth. And there's a lot of them living around L.A. working, you know. But try to find a poet or something, you know, up around Frisco. I know how Frisco people are. They all think we've got this great, neat cultural community up here, you know. And, in fact, they've got a lot of L.A. people snowed into believing it. But if you want to meet people in the arts, it's pretty hard around Frisco, whereas it's very easy in Los Angeles.
That's interesting. John Fahey, can you play another tune for us?
Oh. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Whoops.
John Fahey is my guest, and he's in Philadelphia to perform at the Main Point tonight and tomorrow night. You've done a couple of soundtracks for films. I saw Zabriskie Point, which is one of the films, but don't remember it that well. I was wondering if you wrote the music for the film or if they used your records and just...
Well, actually, no, they only played 2 minutes of me in the whole thing.
Oh, really?
Because I got drunk with Antonioni and over in Italy and told him I used to work for the CIA, which I thought was a joke. I mean, it was a joke.
You told him that you used to work for the CIA?
Yeah.
And you were kidding.
I thought it was absolutely preposterous. How could fat old me work for, you know? And he took it serious and didn't let me know. And so he cut out all the stuff I'd written and left in just 2 minutes of that comes over a car radio, you know, during the thing, and hired Jerry Garcia to do the section I was going to do.
Oh, what did that say to you, that he took you seriously in that?
Well...
Either that you were very convincing.
I still got paid. I thought he was a little too serious about things. I mean, he didn't say, well, surely you're joking. I still can't imagine how anybody could suspect that I...
Why did you tell him that?
We were drunk. I mean, I don't know.
I guess he thought you were confessing under the influence of alcohol.
It's one of those things I can't really explain. I mean, it just seemed like a very amusing thing to say at the time, you know, but it was a terrible faux pas.
Did this...
I don't have the capacity to work for the CIA.
Did you find your sense of humor was stifled after this? You wouldn't tell any jokes like that ever again? You'd lose a lot of gigs because of it?
No, it's the only time anything like that ever happened to me. You know, it's a form of humor to go around saying preposterous things, you know? I mean...
Yeah, a lot of people don't understand that. It's I think, among other things, a very urban humor to do that. I think.
I've been
in some places where I felt that something I said had the possibility of being funny, and at the very least it wasn't intended to be serious, and someone would absolutely take you at face value.
Well,
now, on the other hand, I've been in places where people would say things that they thought were just like really clever, and it made no sense to me at all. I mean, not only was it funny, I had no idea what they were saying.
Right. I've had that happen. But you would think Antonioni, the sophisticated movie producer, maker, would have a, I thought the guy would have a sense of humor.
Yeah.
And I didn't even hear about it, that he took it seriously, until a few days later. And I didn't hear it from him, and I never saw him again.
Well, you have a BA in philosophy and religion, and I've been wondering if that was a major that you took when you were young, because you had to have a major, or if you were involved
really
with...
Still am.
What about now? Do you contemplate the big questions?
Oh, yeah, all the time. I do. I just don't look like it. I don't look like I'm on one of those religious shows, philosophical shows.
Have you ever been involved with a specific religion or group?
Yeah, I've tried several of them, man.
Which ones?
No, I was raised in the Episcopal Church, and I got interested in yoga and meditation in the 60s, the 70s, like everybody else. Maybe I was behind time. And then I began to see yoga, or, for me anyway, began to see yoga and meditation as kind of having a legitimate basis in the East, I went to India, and looked around and did some investigation. I found out most of these swamis that come over here are not recognized swamis in India,
What are they?
There's,
are they considered con men in India?
Considered what?
Con men, or just no one cares about
some
them?
Some of them are considered con men, most of them, take the Swami Bhaktivedanta, the leader of the Hare Krishna sect, is not considered, he's not an orthodox Hindu Swami, he's considered, unless you're a member of his sect, it would be comparable to being a member of some evangelical Christian group in this country, so being the leader of it, something like a Billy Graham, as opposed to being a priest in the Catholic Church, say something like that, he would be considered heterodox. He is considered heterodox. Which doesn't mean that there are people, that he's not respected or anything. He's respected, but he's not actually a member of any of the orthodox Swami orders. And neither is Swami Satchidananda or any of them that are over here that... Now, I know one that's over here, and he doesn't want any more disciples. He's a real nice guy, and he's out in Oklahoma City. But he doesn't go around trying to get people, big groups of people and stuff.
So, what did this trip to India do in terms of your search?
I didn't like India that much. Hindu spirituality, and I think I learned some useful things in yoga, but I ended up pretty much back where I started from, primarily interested in Christianity, not of the evangelical sort, like I'm not interested in converting people or anything like that, that's what I went back to, and I'm pretty happy there. But I did learn some interesting things along the way.
So, what are your plans for...
I'm a Platonist, too. I'm still a Platonist.
Yeah.
I'll never get over that.
So you do what? You do a lot of reading now? And
yeah, I still read a lot. If I was asked, if I had to teach, say, Christian theology or something, I would use, or courses in that, I would use Platonic arguments for a lot of things. I just can't stop being a Platonist. It's a temperamental thing or something.
Well, with your education...
Rather than an Aristotelian, most Catholic theologians tend to be Thomists, and priests are Thomists from St. Thomas Aquinas, who I admire very much, but I would tend to give Platonic arguments for me. Or Augustinian arguments.
What do you do when you're approached by someone from one of the groups who wants to either sell you something or engage you in a discussion of spirituality?
Let's go through some of the groups. I'll tell you what I do, because sometimes it's funny.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, I guess we might as well start with Hare Krishna, since they've been approaching people for years.
Oh, you just say, Hare Bol, I'm a life member, and keep walking. And they won't bother you anymore.
Okay, then there's, was it Isshin Shoshu Buddhism, where you chant Nam-myoho-renge-kyo?
Yeah, I was never bothered. I was only bothered, one guy used to hit me for that, and he was so innocent that I didn't develop elaborate defenses against him, because I just say, hi, how you doing? And, you know. So I haven't really run up against them too much. I don't even know if they're still around too much.
I don't either, to tell you the truth.
You know, I haven't seen anything. Know. They used to have bagpipe bands out west. I mean.
Okay, let's continue our list. Moonies.
Oh, Moonies? I just... For some reason, they never bother me. I would just sort of be obnoxious to them. I mean, I'd just say, scram, you know.
Then,
No, because they're the type that want to engage you in an argument, you know. They're probably trained to do that. You know, I have met them, and if you say one thing, they'll grab a hold of it. So the best thing to do is either not say anything and keep on walking.
And then there's
Or tell them, or just be outright rude, you know.
And there's some new Christian groups.
Yeah, I do the same thing with them. I don't say anything. Because they'll grab a hold of anything you say. And try to engage you. And I don't want to be engaged, you know.
So you're not going to talk to someone who's with the Hare Krishna group about the Bhagavad Gita and compare.
No, I'll gossip with him, though, about members. I know a lot of the members of it, you know, because I live near the world headquarters of it in L.A., and I know a lot of people in it, but...
They wake you up chanting in the morning?
No. No, I'm six blocks away.
Okay. Well, John, we're out of time. It's been a treat to have you here. Thanks very much for speaking with us and for playing for us this afternoon.
Well,
my guest, John Fahey, is going to be at the Main Point this evening and tomorrow night. Two shows, 8 and 10. And here's a number at the Main Point. If you want to call them for any information, it's 525-3375. Once again, that's 525-3375. And I'd like to play you something now from John Fahey's most recent album. It's called John Fahey Visits Washington, D.C. We'll be hearing a medley of Silver Bell and Cheyenne. Then after we hear this, Ralph Flood will be with us with two of his guests who have recently come to America from El Salvador. So this is John Fahey.
Thank you.
John Fahey, a medley of Silver Bell and Cheyenne from his newest record, which is called John Fahey Visits Washington, D.C., and today John Fahey Visits Philadelphia. Well, it's 2 minutes to 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Coming up on Fresh Air, WUHY's Ralph Flood is going to speak with two people about El Salvador. But before I introduce Ralph, I would just like to say that this is officially Ralph's last day here at WUHY. He's accepted a teaching position, which he'll be leaving for. We're all going to miss him very much, so I just want to take out a moment to wish Ralph Flood the best of luck, and I hope he keeps in touch with all of us. Okay, Ralph, hi.
Thank you very much, Terry. I promise I will. Well, what we've got to talk about this afternoon is the murder of an archbishop and the death in the desert of 13 Salvadorans. Not a very pleasant subject, but one that suddenly opened the eyes of Americans to the convulsions of a little country of 5 million people that most of us barely knew existed. The fact that something is dreadfully wrong in El Salvador has not, by and large, been related in our media to the role of the United States government in the terror there. Stories of atrocity occurring within hospitals to patients, doctors, and nurses prompted a group of health professionals in this country to form a delegation of 5, doctors and teachers, to travel to El Salvador for a preliminary investigation of the charges. At the same time, the disparate opposition political groups in El Salvador have formed a united front, the National Revolutionary Movement, and they're sending ambassadors around the world to generate financial support for their cause and pressure against the United States, which is apparently, once again, acting as the mainstay of an extraordinarily savage and violent reign of terror. It's my honor to have in the studio two people representing those two missions, Dr. Walter Lear, who returned last week with the medical team, and Professor Jose Arias, a representative of the National Revolutionary Movement. Dr. Lear is an old friend of Fresh Air. He's a former Pennsylvania Department of Health commissioner for Southeast Pennsylvania, and currently he's the president of the Institute of Social Medicine and Community Health in Philadelphia and president of the Physicians Forum, one of the groups sponsoring the mission to El Salvador. Dr. Arias is professor of economics at the Central American University in San Salvador and minister of agriculture. He was minister of agriculture in El Salvador from in 1975 and 1976. Gentlemen, welcome to Fresh Air. Dr. Arias was originally scheduled to be with us today, but then there was some mix-up, and we got word that Ruben Zamora, another member of that delegation from the National Revolutionary Movement, was going to be here. He was secretary to the presidency of the current junta until he resigned in January of this year, as did a number of other ministers in that present government. And Dr. Zamora then went to Washington today and is meeting currently with the State Department. I imagine, Dr. Arias, that that's a good sign for your side. What does it mean, the fact that Mr. Zamora is currently meeting with the State Department?
Well, I think one of the main points we have been looking for here in the United States is to put clear what is going on in our country, because the first thing we find in every country we go is that the misinformation is the more important way they are covering the real situation in our country. And in this meaning is why now is being an appointment in the State Department with this mission of the front.
I see. So it's an informational meeting with
yes.
the State Department.
Yes.
All right. Well, we don't know much about El Salvador here. Could you give me very briefly a sketch, an outline, some background of what that nation, how that nation has come about, where how it developed, going back even to the 19th century?
Yes. Well, my country is a country of almost 21,000 square kilometers, and with almost 5 million of people. It's a country that is in Central America. We are neighborhood of Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Our country is a country that all its wealth is coming from the land, the rural area. Our main products are coffee, cotton, sugar, sugar cane, and other products. Our country, the first important thing we can say it about it from the last century is that at the last quarter of the last century, our country suffered defense action against its population when there was passed a law taking away the land from the peasants just to form the coffee plantation.
By big landholders?
By big landholders, mainly from other countries that arrived to our country.
From other countries?
Yes, that now they are Salvadorian. Mm-hmm. They developed this coffee plantation that is the main origin of the wealthy from the oligarchy. And this condition started to develop a very difficult situation for our population, and this was expressed clearly in 1932, when our population, in a very difficult social, economic, and political situation, tried exasperated to take power just to rebuild the country to solve their own problems. And our population hasn't a very well-organized background, and this was one of the main points why this insurrection finished with the killing of more than 30,000 people.
An insurrection. 30,000
And from
killed.
This time on, we have been suffering a military regime that is expressed clear in an institutional dictatorship. We don't have Somoza, we don't have Batista, but we have an institution as a dictatorship that only changed its face from some days.
So it's not identified with any one big man.
This is the regime we have been living. This institution has been always uniquely serving the oligarchy, protecting their own interests. And this is why our population has been pushing to a very radical social, economic, and political suffering. This was put into the people in developing some conscience and started to understand how in this way they couldn't continue and decided to start to be organized just to get power. This is how around 1970, after all the elections campaign that had been participated for some Democratic Party had failed, even that they continued in elections 73 and 77, that they succeeded in winning it, but they couldn't take power because the result from this election always being a fraud and increasing repression. For the
So the military comes in when a democratic election has been attempted, they come in, throw out the results, and take over.
Yes, because the candidate for the military has always had been a military people that expressed the interest of this oligarchy. And in this way, how the population has been living, you can say how the income of our population is around less than a dollar for a people a day. We have that.